2009, U.S. Airways Flight 1549 was taking off from LaGuardia Airport in New York and struck a large flock of Canadian geese shortly after takeoff. The geese were sucked into the engines, completely destroying both of them. And all of this apparently happened at 2,800 feet off the ground. And so with no thrust to keep the aircraft flying and surrounded by nothing but the New York City skyline, Captain Chelsea Sullenberger quickly determined that he didn't have enough altitude to reach any surrounding airport, and that the only place that he could safely land the airplane was in the Hudson River. Now, this is an extremely dangerous maneuver, since there has never been a successful water landing by an airliner where somebody hasn't died. And so the fact of the matter is, though, he didn't have any other choice. Now, do you realize what it takes to pull off a landing like that? I mean, the angle of descent has to be perfect. It has to be precise, or the entire plane could just disintegrate when it hit the water. And so the amazing thing is that Captain Sullenberger did it. He remarkably belly landed the plane while keeping it intact, and in the process he saved the lives of 155 people on board. And he was hailed as a hero, and the one question that people were saying was it was called the Miracle on the Hudson. How did he do it? How was he able to do it? One word: experience. Experience. Sullenberger was a one-time Air Force fighter pilot and had more than 40 years of flight experience. He had over 20,000 hours of flying time when this accident happened. Most people believe that had there been any a man of lesser experience flying that plane, that things would have turned out quite differently for Flight 1549. What you learn is experience made the difference. Experience. Well, when it comes to the scripture here, what we could say, we could really say the same thing about the Apostle Paul, that when it comes to the issue of hardship, there has been no one else in history with more experience in dealing with hardship other than the Apostle Paul, with the possible exception of Jesus Christ himself. Now, how can I say that? Well, because remember what we learned in 2 Corinthians, when he describes in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 23 through 28, that the numerous times that he had been beaten and imprisoned and shipwrecked and abused and in grave danger for his life, and all for the sake of the gospel. And having gone through all of that, what he learned is he learned the secret of perseverance. He learned how to endure hardship while maintaining a joyful and a thankful spirit. And this, in part, is why he writes the letter of Philippians. And what we can learn from this book is that no other man can really be a greater guide to help us navigate the treacherous waters and the breakwater shoals of hardship other than the Apostle Paul. Not because he was some super Christian, not because he didn't have weakness and sinfulness just like we do, but simply because he had so much experience at it. From Philippians, we learn this principle of life, that it is possible to be joyful even when life gets hard. I like what the Life Application Commentary says at this point. Joy can be discovered in the pain and struggles of life. At a funeral, knowing through tears that your loved one now lives with God. in a hospital bed, knowing that the Lord stands near, in an unemployment office, knowing that God will provide all your needs. True joy runs deep and strong, flowing from confident assurance in God's loving control. Regardless of your life situation, you can find joy, true joy, in Christ. Now, that's a marvelous statement. It is this unspeakable joy that's developed in the human heart by the working of the Holy Spirit that enables you to persevere. And that's what we see Paul doing in Philippians. He is persevering. Persevering in the midst of hardship with his joy still intact. Now, how do we know that? Because if you do a study of the book of Philippians, you'll note that some 16 times throughout the book, Paul mentions the fact how joyful and how filled with rejoicing that he is, and how we should be joyful in whatever circumstances we find ourselves in. The amazing thing about the book of Philippians is that it's really, yes, it's a letter, but really what it is a thank you note. It's a long thank you note. Paul writes to the Philippians because they had sent, you remember, the Corinthians really didn't like Paul. We learned that last week. But in contrast to that, the Philippians, they loved him. And when they found out that he was in prison, they got the church together and they sent this huge love offering to Paul. And so Paul is writing back this thank you note we call the book of Philippians. Now, Paul's joy is extraordinary, given the fact that he's writing this book from prison. Right? This is his first Roman imprisonment, which means that he was under house arrest. He was guarded 24/7 by a Roman guard, chained to that Roman guard. Now, most of us would find it, really difficult to be joyful in a situation like that. But Paul is, even in chains. This is what he writes in chapter 1, verse 12. He says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. And because of this, I rejoice. In other words, one of the other reasons why he's writing to the church in Philippi is because he doesn't want his friends there to worry about him. Essentially, he's saying, it's okay, guys. Don't get discouraged. Don't lose heart. Don't worry about me, because really everything that has happened to me has turned out better than I could ever have planned it. Because you see, ever since Paul came to Christ, the one place he wanted to go was Rome. Well, he got there, but not quite the way he kind of hoped to be there. He got there as a prisoner. So he says, I don't want you to worry. He says, because even though I'm in prison, the gospel is making inroads into places we never thought possible. Though I'm in prison, the gospel isn't. Hardship has not hindered the gospel. In fact, he says, it's blazed a trail for it. It's given us opportunities that we never would have had otherwise. And because of this, I rejoice. You see, that's what we don't understand about hardship. Hardship is often that ugly little blessing that can be an avenue through which God can bless our life. I remember, and you know this, several years ago, back when we were in Colorado, my wife was pregnant with our third baby, and she miscarried. We lost her. But yet several years later, we had the opportunity to have an exchange student in our home. Her name was Marisa. She was from Germany. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder, had that baby not died. I mean, if we had had three kids and would we have had the room? I don't know. I mean, I was just thinking about it the other day, I was thinking, I don't know if that baby had lived, had would we have had the, you know, would we have said, well, yeah, I just don't really want another, you know, fourth person take care of a fourth person. So maybe we wouldn't have had it. And if so, had that baby not died, maybe we wouldn't have said, yeah, we want to take on this exchange student for a year. And then we wouldn't have gotten to know Marisa. We wouldn't have gotten to know her. And she has really been just a blessing to our family. So, you know, those ugly little blessings, that hardship sometimes can be an avenue through which God can bless your life. And yet, what are we always praying, folks? What are we always praying? We're always, when trials hit our life, hard times come, we're always saying, God, take it away, please. This hurts. I don't like this. And what we don't realize is that sometimes, often, joy grows best in the soil of pain and problems and setbacks and trials and tragedy. And if you're like me, you'd be like, you know, I'd really like to be able to do that. I'd like to be able to be joyful no matter what the circumstances were. I'd like to be joyful in the midst of pain. But you know what? That's not easy to do. So how do you do that? Well, we go to Paul, and Paul clues us in on that little issue in our text this morning, and what we learn is this, that we can have joy even in the midst of hardship if knowing Jesus better is the ultimate goal of our life. See, the real issue of persevering in the race is knowing where the finish line is, right? It's being fixated on the goal. See, the goal is what keeps you running. The goal is the thing that you want so bad in life that you're willing to go through hell and high water in order to get it, in order to reach that goal. I recently saw a story of a guy. His name was Sammy. He lived in France. His girlfriend was French, and he really wanted, you know, he really wanted to start dating her, and he made advances toward her, you know, respectfully, but she's like, I just want a guy, she says, I don't know how serious you are, she says, but I just want a guy who will do whatever it takes, you know, to show his love. He says, well, you know what, I would climb up Mount Everest for you. And she thought, oh, you're just joking. He did it. He left for Nepal, the very place I'm going to. And he actually climbed Mount Everest to prove his love for Nadia, the girl that he loved. His goal was ultimately her love. And you know, I think about that. There had to be many times during that trek up the mountain. We're talking about 29,000 feet, folks. I mean, that's not an easy climb. There had to be many times during that trek up the mountain when the pain and the cold was so much that he felt like quitting. And yet the goal of gaining her love was greater than the pain that he was enduring the farther up he climbed. And see, that's one of the keys to persevering through hardship. The goal has got to be bigger than the pain. Because if it's not, you'll quit. That's why I'm going to Nepal, but I ain't going up Everest. I can tell you that right now. Because I'm thinking, I mean, why would I want to go and do that? Just to say I did it? That's not enough. That's not a big enough goal for me to do something like that. The goal has to be bigger than the pain. Otherwise, you're going to slow down. You're going to fade back. You're going to drop out. You're ultimately going to ask yourself, is this really worth it? Well, it was to Sammy. Which is why he kept climbing. And it was to Paul, which is why he kept running, even though he was in prison. So, well, then, what was Paul's goal in life? Well, you you see it there. He tells us several times in this passage what it was. Look, if you look at verse 8, he says his goal is the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ. And in the latter part of verse 8, he says his goal is that I might gain Christ. And then again, he says it more clearly in verse 10. He says, I want to know Christ. See, that was his goal. That was his goal in life, to know Jesus more deeply, more fully, more completely. Now, we look at that and we say, well, I don't understand. What do you mean you want to know Christ, Paul? I mean, doesn't he already know him? Isn't he already a Christian? Well, of course he is. Understand, he's not, when he's speaking of knowing Christ, he's not speaking in the sense of conversion. It's not that Paul is having second thoughts or doubts about whether or not he's truly saved. But what he means is that he wants to know Jesus in the sense of having a deeper, intimate, more personal knowledge of Jesus. Now let me describe this to you. Let me illustrate what he's trying to say. If I were to tell you, I know the President of the United States, you'd probably look at me and you'd probably say, well, I know him too. Because what I mean when I say I know the President of the United States, what I mean is that I know of him, right? I know what he looks like. I could pick him out of a crowd. I know him from afar. But now, if the president's son, Barron, says, well, I know the President of the United States, what he means is altogether different than what I mean. Because when Barron says that he knows the president, he means, you may know him as the President of the United States, but I know him as Dad. He's my dad. I know him the way only a son can know a father. And this is what Paul means when he uses this particular Greek word to know. It's not knowing in the sense of being able to recall certain facts. It's not a Sunday school knowledge. It's knowing in the sense of a personal, experiential knowledge of Jesus that goes beyond the surface. This word often is used in the New Testament to describe the sexual union between husband and wife. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 25, and if you use the King James Version, it says this, he, meaning Joseph, knew her not, her meaning Mary, until she had brought forth her firstborn son. So the word know there is the same word in Greek, ginosko, that Paul uses in our text. In other words, marriage was the Greeks used the idea of knowing, a man knowing his wife, it was a euphemism for knowing her intimately sexually. It's intimate knowledge. That's why marriage is the most intimate personal relationship that a human being can ever have with another human being. See, my wife knows me in a way that you will never know me. She can look at me in certain situations and know exactly what I'm thinking or what I'm about to say. You know, it's like when she goes looking for something, invariably she's going to say, where did you put it, Chris? And I say, well, what are you looking at me for? Well, because she knows how when I clean the house, man, I clean it. I put all this stuff in one area. I don't like clutter. I like stuff, you know. And even if you don't have a place to put it, let's all put it in one place so it's not all over the house. So when I clean, she comes looking for something. She's going to come looking for me. She's going to say, Chris, where is this? I said, you know, I don't know. I don't know. Why do you ask me? Because she says, I know you. I know how you clean. Right? How does she know me so well? Because we've been married for 25 years. experience. See, and it goes both ways. I know about, I don't just know about Karen. I know her deeply more thoroughly than any other person, any other human being on earth. I know her likes and her dislikes. Yes, after 25 years of marriage, I finally figured out that, you know, because I always get up early. I was up at 4 o'clock this morning. I always get up early. I found out that she doesn't really like me, you know, getting back in bed with her, you know, and putting my cold feet on her. She didn't like that. Now, I still do it. I shouldn't, but I still do it. But I need warm sometimes, you know. But see, I know her strengths, her weaknesses. I know her eccentricities and her battles. I know her in a way that no other person will. See, that's what experience and intimacy does for you. And that's the kind of intimate knowledge Paul wants to have with Jesus. That's his goal in life. That's the goal he's running toward. And he's fixated on it. He's obsessed with it. He's obsessed with knowing Jesus more and better and deeper and stronger than he did the day before. He's a driven man. As driven as Sammy was, you know, trekking up Mount Everest to earn Nadia's love. That's why that's why Paul doesn't quit. Because he says in verse 8, he says because this knowledge is a surpassing knowledge. He says the surpassing greatness of knowing Jesus Christ my Lord is far greater than any accomplishment or trophy or accolade or celebrity that has ever come my way, says Paul. See, here's what you're going to discover about Jesus when you start walking with him, when you've been walking with Jesus. You find out that there is no end to him. There's no end to how wonderful he is. And you will find as you walk with Jesus, you'll be like Paul, you know, you'll be walking with Jesus some 30, 40 years and still never find an end to his greatness. There's always something more to learn. There's always something more to discover and savor about him. I think back a couple years ago when I was teaching at Kroll, when I decided I knew I had to end that position because it was not helping me with the ministry. It was keeping me from the ministry. I was just like, I'm not sure how I'm going to extricate myself from this situation with any dignity. I've only been teaching for a very short time, and how can I go to my wife and say, I got to quit because this ain't working for me? How can I go to the principal and say, I got to quit because this ain't working? How am I going to get, you know, out of this with any shred of dignity whatsoever? And yet, the amazing thing is that, you know, Ginny, our principal, was just so kind. She was just so kind. And, I mean, she protected me and stood up for me. And, I mean, and I saw Christ in all of that. And what I discovered through that whole situation is I discovered the depth of the Lord's kindness. That whenever I get myself into an inescapable situation, he'll make a way for me. And what I discovered is that Jesus will always come for me. For that, I bless his name. I bless his name. Jesus Christ is the kindest person I have ever known. That's not like I didn't know that before. But I have discovered the depths of it through experience. And Paul discovered that as well. And more about Jesus. Paul has, what you notice about Paul when he talks about it, he says, I want to know Christ. I want to know the surpassing greatness of Christ. What you discover is that Paul is kind of like an obsessed archaeologist. The more he unearths about Jesus, the more he wanted to know him. That's why he refers to this as the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ. The more he knew, the more he wanted to know. He was hungry for Jesus. And what he found is that Jesus always satisfied his hunger. See, Jesus never disappoints. Jesus, you never walk away empty and unsatisfied from Jesus. You're always filled to overflowing, and yet you want more. And the more you want, the more he fills you. I mean, think about that for just a minute. What do you have in life that you can honestly say that does that for you? I mean, you can't say that about money, because guess what? Money doesn't stick around, does it? You always need more of it. And whatever you got never seemed to be enough. You can't say that about cars or homes or vacations. Cars rust and get into crashes. Homes, well, people always looking for better houses than the one they got. Vacations, no matter how good they are, they always come to an end. But Jesus never comes to an end. He always satisfies. And see, that's why Paul is rejoicing, even in prison. And this is why he hasn't given up, why he's still in the race, because what he's discovered is that when knowing Jesus better is the goal of your life, then there's no hardship in life that can keep you from advancing toward the goal. Because the principle is, hardship doesn't keep you from knowing Jesus, it actually can help you propel towards that goal. Honestly, you know, and I'm sure you could probably say the same thing. Honestly, I've learned more about Jesus going through hard times than I ever have going through good times. And that's what we find here. Being in prison is actually helping Paul persevere in his faith. It's not retarding it. Well, you can't say that about any other goal. What is the goal of your life? See, if your goal is to have a nicer car, you need to understand something. Yeah, it's nice if you can get one, but you know what? Hardship at any time in your life can take that from you. Because see, even if you got a nice car, if you can't drive it if you're in prison, can you? You can't live in a comfortable home. You can't make money. You can't go on vacation if you're in prison. If those are the goals of your life, and you know, hardship can at any time take those things from you. And then what? But see, if your goal is knowing Jesus better, if you're fixated upon that goal, you're untouchable. Why? Because you always have Christ. You have this all-consuming love that Jesus has for you. And nothing the world can do can separate you from that. No problem, no hardship, no setback, no tragedy. Nothing can separate you from Jesus. And isn't that what Paul has said before? We go to Romans chapter 8, some of our favorite passages, and what do we hear Paul saying? He says to us, verse 35, "Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or the sword?" No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I am convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither the height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. You see, when your goal is knowing Christ, if your goal in life is to know more about Him and to, you know, to love Him more, there is nothing in this world that can touch that.